We're continuing our study this morning concerning the God who is there. It's an extended study we've engaged in on the evidences for the existence of God. And I want to begin the lesson this morning by posing this idea to you. I want you to use your imagination a little bit. What if you heard that there was someone walking the earth today who claimed to be from outer space? Now, that's a theme in some of the movies that get made from time to time and some of the books that are written in the science fiction genre. The one that really comes to mind for me right now is one that was made back in the early 50s, and there's been a couple of remakes of it since then, called The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which a giant sphere, which apparently was a spaceship, lands on Earth, and a man steps out of it. But what if you heard that there was a man walking the earth today, right here in America, maybe right here in Texas, who claimed to be from somewhere else? Now, the interesting thing is, he doesn't look any different than anyone else. Sometimes in those science fiction, fictionalized movies that are made, they try to make sure you can tell that they're not from here by giving them pointy ears or making them look like a lizard that walks or some other strange thing about them, so biologically they obviously are not human. But this person looks just like everybody else. And should you hear him speak, he sounds just like everybody else. He speaks the same language as everyone else. And if you did a little investigating, you would find out that he was born like everybody else. You could identify the place where he was born and who his parents were. And yet, he claims to be from somewhere else. He didn't arrive by means of spaceship. He doesn't have pointy ears. He doesn't speak in a strange language that no one else on earth speaks. But in addition to his claim that he's from somewhere else, there are these stories that are circulating concerning him. Stories about him doing things that normal people are not able to do. Things we might even label as supernatural or miraculous. There's also stories not only of what he does, but some of the things he says, some of the things he tells others that seem to be the only the things that someone not from this world would be able to do. And he claims that these things are what will verify who he is. What would it take to convince you that he really was not of this world? Now, the truth is, there are some people who would say, nothing would ever convince me. Since he doesn't look any different, he doesn't sound any different, you would not be able to convince me, some would say, that this person is from somewhere else than on earth. They would claim that they would be able to use science or reason or something else to explain away or discount everything this person said or did in order to prove, in their mind at least, that he was just a human being. But for many others, is it not possible that eventually this person could say enough and do enough that is totally outside the realm of what we would consider possible to be explained in strictly human terms, that finally we would conclude he is, in fact, from somewhere outside of Earth? Now, what if this person isn't walking the Earth today, but was on Earth 200 years ago? That means we wouldn't actually get to see him ourselves, hear from living people that they saw him do these things that convinced them that he was not of this Earth. So he lived 200 years ago, but those who did see him and those who did hear him and who did witness all these things and who did come to the conclusion that he was not of this earth wrote down what they saw and heard. Not just one book, but numerous books were written by eyewitnesses. And they documented these things. And now here we are 200 years later reading in these books about this person. And we're trying to decide, are these believable? Are these witnesses trustworthy? In a real sense, that's what we have when we talk about Jesus, isn't it? As we introduced the idea last week, when we talk about the existence of God, that some 2,000 years ago, a man appears on earth. Not appears in the sense that he was beamed down in Star Trek fashion, but he, nevertheless, is suddenly on earth. He didn't arrive here by spaceship. He was born in a little town named Bethlehem in the ancient nation of Judea. He grew up there, and from the very beginning, even before his arrival, stories were already swirling about that this was a most unusual child, a most unusual person. And then when he reached adulthood, as he started traveling about that small nation, not only teaching things that, as those who heard him say, no one has ever spoken like this before, but started doing things that no one had ever seen such things done before. But the things he did, though they were categorized as supernatural, even miraculous, were not in the category of blowing away mountains or suddenly stretching out his hand and 1,000 people died. But they were instead activities and actions that expressed or demonstrated great care and compassion and giving and healing, but nevertheless were supernatural. That's the declaration concerning Jesus. We're talking about matters of history. If God does exist, and if He did in fact visit this planet, He chose to verify that for generations after that event through history. We're talking about things that are matters of history. Here's some things we do know from a historical perspective. Now, you hear critics all the time, you know, I'm always disappointed, I guess, when I watch the History Channel or the Discovery Channel, my two favorite channels other than ESPN, or actually Fox Southwest because they carry the Texas Rangers there. But beyond that, History Channel and Discovery Channel, I'm always disappointed at some of the programs that are put on there, how little attention they pay to the true value of history, how fast and loose they can be with the facts, almost telling people, if you'll just ignore what we know from history, we'll tell you what really happened. That's not how you study history. But we know this for a fact from history. Number one, there was a very unique man named Jesus who lived in a small nation of Judea some 2,000 years ago at the very beginning of the first century of the Common Era, or what we used to call A.D. That fact alone was once questioned. There started up a movement about 100 years ago, more or less, in which men were saying, we really don't know if there was such a person as Jesus. After 100 years of that idea being floated out there and tested and studied and tried and examined and challenged, you would be hard-pressed to find any man with any credentials of any kind in the fields of history or scholarship who would make such a claim today. It's universally accepted that such a person did in fact live. That's a fact of history. It's also a fact of history that within the same generation in which he lived, a fast spreading movement began based on the belief in who he was and what he taught. This movement, originally known by terms such as the Nazarenes, or the Way, or a little bit later, the Church, and which now is classified more generally as the Christians and Christianity. This fast-spreading movement that began at the same time that he lived spread across the ancient world, particularly the Roman Empire, and untold thousands of people, hearing the stories about this man, became partakers or a part of this movement. And before that first century was over, went through two severe persecutions for what they believed, and yet untold thousands of them went to their death rather than renounce what they had come to believe about this man. That's a fact of history. It's a fact of history that 12 men who claimed to be eyewitnesses to what this man did and to what this man said, were a part of spreading that teaching that led to this movement. These men we commonly call today by the name apostles had names like Peter and James and John. They were at a little bit later date, a few years after they first began their work, joined by a 13th man by the name of Paul, originally called Saul of Tarsus. And they persuasively convinced many, many people that what they were saying concerning this person was true, because they said they were eyewitnesses. And the eyewitnesses were not limited to the 12 or the 13, because there were actually hundreds of others as well who had seen and heard him, who lended their voices in support. And it's a fact of history that within one generation of him having lived, a number of documents were written and widely propagated throughout this early community of Christians, which set forth in written form his teachings and his miracles and his claims, as well as what the beliefs of those people who followed him were. Over time, those documents were gradually gathered together into a single volume, although that happened some 200 to 300 years later. And copies of those early documents gathered together into a single volume are still available today. They're called the Bible or the New Testament. And some have challenged these documents as whether or not they can be trusted or whether they are reliable or whether we can believe them. Even though all the evidence is that the very latest of all the documents was written less than 65 years after he lived. I did a little quick search this morning before I came to church. You know, sometimes we question whether or not we hear people questioning whether or not we can trust the things we read in the New Testament, in the Gospels about Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, whether we can believe the things that are written in the book of Acts, written by Luke, all the epistles, the letters that have been collected together of Paul and Peter and John and Jude. Let me lead you on a little detour just for a moment, a detour that I think is very important. If you wanted to know something about Abraham Lincoln, where would you go? Today, the definitive, but not the only, but the definitive so-called history of Abraham Lincoln is found in a 6 or 7 volume set written by a man by the name of Carl Sandburg. Now, there's numerous other biographies of Lincoln as well. But if you look down the whole list of the biographies of Abraham Lincoln that are universally accepted by scholars of every kind as being accurate, trustworthy, dependable records of what Lincoln was like, what he said, what he did, the history of his times, you go to these volumes. And let me tell you something. Not a single one of the volumes that are of the biographies of Lincoln were written in the same generation he lived. Sandburg started being printed in 1931, 65 years after Lincoln died. Sandburg hadn't even been born when Lincoln died. Sandburg did not know Lincoln. Sandburg did not know any significant person who knew Lincoln. And yet he wrote what is considered to be the final word on Abraham Lincoln. Every scholar will accept what Sandburg wrote about Lincoln. And yet here we have a case in which 2,000 years ago, yes, within the same generation, that is, during the time when people were still alive, who had been alive when Jesus was alive and on this earth, we have these many documents written concerning him, and they don't want to accept those. But they'll accept what Carl Sandburg said. Well, what about George Washington, father of our nation? Died shortly after the beginning of the 1800s, I believe. The most commonly accepted definitive biography of George Washington was written by a man by the name of Douglas Freeman. Again, a multi-volume set. We're not talking about something you read over a weekend. It's something you go to the library and check out volume by volume. And it was published in 1948, 150 years roughly after Washington died. Does anyone question its accuracy, its veracity, its dependability to accurately tell us what Washington was like? No. But it was written 150 years after, which means at least 125 years after anybody was even alive who knew Washington. But we accept that. Benjamin Franklin. Walter Isaacson's biography on Benjamin Franklin, who was a contemporary of George Washington, so lived and died roughly in the same period of time, was published in 2004 and has been widely hailed by scholars everywhere as being the one biography to read on Benjamin Franklin, written 200 years after the man died. John Adams, one of the other presidents of our country, the biography that's most commonly accepted concerning him was written by David McCullough and published in 2001. Again, almost 200 years after John Adams died and left this earth, or at least passed from this earth. What I'm saying is, from a historical standpoint, we are extremely blessed to have four biographies of Jesus written within the same generation in which he lived by three of them eyewitnesses. And the fourth one, who interviewed and compiled his information based on those interviews with eyewitnesses. That would be Luke. So from a historical standpoint, there should be no question, no serious question, about whether or not these documents are reliable. The only reason people would question them is because they reject the conclusion, not because they're historically unreliable. But then those who actually lived and knew Jesus, some of them rejected the conclusion as well. In Luke chapter 8, in the passage that was read to us at the beginning of the service, we go to these documents that allow us 2,000 years later to know enough about this person named Jesus to possibly come to the conclusion that he truly was not just a man, that he was, in fact, what he claimed to be and what those who knew him and saw him and were with him came to the conclusion that he was of God, from God. And even in some passages, they would say he was God on earth. And so in Luke in chapter 8, we have one of those stories recorded by Luke. And it says, one day Jesus in verse 22 said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. The Galilee Lake, sometimes called the Sea of Galilee, was some, you know, I guess 8 miles across and about 30 miles long. But it was located in a narrow canyon almost, so that at certain times, because of the way the winds blew down that canyon and across the lake in the late evening and early nighttime, that they could have quite severe storms on it. And we're not talking about, you know, a 120-foot pleasure craft here. We're talking about a rather small fishing boat that's trying to make its way across the lake. And he's fallen asleep in the boat. But the storm has come up. And even though these men, most of them were experienced sailors, having been fishermen all their life on that lake, they are in fear for their lives because they think the boat is going to sink. And so the disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." And he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. So they go from a very severe storm with their life being in imminent danger to complete calm in a matter of moments. "Where is your faith?" he asked his disciples. What's he talking about? Didn't they trust him? He's saying. "Haven't you already told me you said you knew who I was?" he's saying to them. "Where's your faith?" In fear and amazement, they ask one another, "Who is this? Even the winds and the water obey his command." They'd already come to believe that he could heal people. They'd already come to accept the fact that he could teach them things about God and what God wanted them to do that no one else could. They'd already come to accept that. But even then, their belief in who he was wasn't a big enough belief. They already believed he was special and different. They just didn't believe he was that different. And that, in a little bit later story, He will come to them actually walking on the water. Matthew tells us that story in chapter 14. This time they were sailing back across the lake, and as they were going across the lake, Jesus had stayed on shore during the night. But again, they hit rough water. It wasn't the same kind of storm that we've just read about here, but nevertheless, it was enough that they couldn't make headway as they were trying to get across the lake. And so they'd been rowing and most of the night and still hadn't made it all the way across. Then suddenly they look back from the direction they came, and here comes Jesus. And he's not swimming. He's not in a powerboat. He's walking on the water. I know that would, on one hand, sound incredible to us, except we're listening to eyewitnesses tell what they saw. They see him walking on the water, and at first they think it's some apparition, some ghost, some vision they're having. They can't imagine a real person walking on water because they haven't yet truly imagined who Jesus was. But in verse 27 of Matthew 14, Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." And Peter, one of the disciples, said, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." Peter was always opening his mouth before he engaged his mind. I think if he had thought for a moment, he would have come up with some other test other than, "Jesus, if it's really you, then have me come out and walk on the water too. I don't think I'm quite that bold. Just in case, you know, just in case. Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." And as Jesus apparently is still walking towards him and getting closer, he says, "Come." Then Peter got down out of the boat and walked on the water to Jesus. But as he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, rescue me." And immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him and said, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they both climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." Jewish people over many centuries learned a very hard, dear lesson. You don't worship anybody but God. You don't worship men. You don't worship angels. You don't worship idols. You only worship God. You would rather die than worship anything or anyone other than God Himself. And these men worshiped Jesus. They recognized that He is not an angel, not just someone from outer space. He's God. That's their conclusion. This is not the only time they will end up doing that. We read their biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the biography is not entirely an accurate description of what these books are, but they come close. We read in there that Jesus Himself said that He had the power to forgive sins, something only God could do. Mark chapter 2. He said that "I am the one the prophets talked about." All those prophecies we talked about 2 weeks ago that we read in the Old Testament about a coming special one from God. Jesus says, "I am Him." Once in a very heated discussion with some of the Jewish leadership who failed to accept who He was, even though they admitted the things He did, He asked them, "Why do you want to stone me?" They wanted to kill Him. He said, "Why do you want to stone me? For which one of the miracles do you want to kill me?" And they said, "Not for the miracles you did, but because you claimed, being merely a man, to be God." Duh. What's the problem here? You look at the evidence, but you can't draw the conclusion. They admitted the evidence. On one occasion when He raised a man from the dead by the name of Lazarus, someone all of them knew personally, because Lazarus lived right on the outskirts of Jerusalem and was a wealthy man apparently and well known in the upper class, which is what the religious leadership was made up of. He died, and after 4 days, Jesus arrived and went to the tomb and called him alive out of the tomb. Some of them believed. Others said, "Now we're going to have to kill Lazarus too, because him being alive makes everybody believe that Jesus is God." Jesus claimed to be from heaven, from God, the Son of God, even saying on one occasion in John chapter 8 that "I am." Now that just sounds like an odd sentence to us, but to every Jewish person, the real name of God, Jehovah or Yahweh, literally translated meant the I am because I am. And Jesus says, I am. He wasn't just declaring that he existed. That was obvious. He's declaring who he was. And immediately they took up stones to try to stone him to death. Those who saw him documented that he performed miracles of all kinds. As we've already said, but they were miracles of caring, of compassion, or of provision. Miracles of power. Not power to destroy things, but power to create things. Power to overcome evil. Power to destroy death by raising people from the dead. They worshiped him. They said, we are witnesses of these things. One of the men who led the persecution against the early believers who didn't believe in Jesus, a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus, suddenly himself changes and spends the rest of his life declaring to everyone with great influence and power that Jesus was in fact from God and was the one they had been looking for. And people believed them. People who lived in the very place and at the very time where all these things supposedly happened, believed them. And first hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands of people said, I believe that he is the one. And so this movement began right there in the place where it all supposedly happened. It wasn't that people were believing in something that happened long ago and far away. They were believing in something that happened right there and then while they were there. And they had seen those things happen, but they hadn't yet had anyone convince them of what it proved. But now they were convinced. And this movement then spread out from there all across the Roman Empire. And the evidence is even that it got carried to all other parts of the earth where men lived as well. But we know best the story of the Roman Empire and where untold thousands of not just Jewish people who were the first believers, but also those who had Greek as their language and as their ethnic origin, and those who were Romans who spoke Latin and were from the Roman upper class, or the ruling class over all the empire, all of them also were accepting that these things were true. They believed the witnesses. They accepted them as true. And they started to practice two things, that even these things in and of themselves confess their faith. Every one of them to become a follower of Jesus was baptized, saying that they were imitating the death and the burial and the resurrection from the dead of Jesus in being baptized. And in doing that, they believed that he was forgiving them of their sins, something only God could do. Every person who was baptized in the first century was confessing their faith in who and what Jesus was. And then they began to practice on a regular basis as small groups of people a meal together. But it wasn't a traditional meal in which, you know, they would have the fish and the baked bread that was traditional for the Jewish people or whatever the Greeks and the Romans ate. But it was a special meal that because it was ceremonial, it was emblematic. They called it the supper, the communion. And it looked a lot like what we did just a few minutes, in which bread would be passed around and everyone would take a piece. And then the cup would be passed around, filled with the fruit of the vine, the juice of the grape, because it looked in some ways like blood. And they would all drink from it. And in doing that, they were reminding themselves that Jesus had died on a cross for them. But they weren't just celebrating a past hero that they would never see again. But they were doing it in expectation that one day he would come back and celebrate it with them until he comes again. Anyone who wants to talk about the existence of God needs to talk about Jesus and explain who he was. Explain how it's possible that we have these records that have come down to us after 2,000 years, written in the same generation and by those who were eyewitnesses of how he was able to do these things, including the very pinnacle of all of it was when they killed him. And it seems clear from the records that he allowed that to happen. He didn't make it happen. But he allowed it to happen. They were so infuriated because of his claims that they felt so threatened by what he was claiming that they felt like they needed to get rid of him. And so they killed him and he allowed them to. And 3 days later, when they go to the tomb, the huge stone that sealed the tomb was moved, and the tomb was empty. And then they begin to see him alive. First one, then another, then a group, and then another group, and then at one time, over 500 at one time. All see him alive. He's resurrected from the dead. He presented more than enough evidence to support his claims. And no significant evidence to the contrary has ever been found and presented. Much more evidence, in fact, than almost any other historical figure, especially of ancient times. More than enough evidence to convince us, if we can be convinced, of who he was. And so we can say, along with those early disciples, who is this that even the winds and waves obey his commands? Was he not, in fact, as one of his names said, Emmanuel, God among us? The evidence that God exists because he's visited this earth. We have an invitation song. It invites us to think about how strong the evidence is for the faith we hold. Yet there's so many people who still don't believe. Many of them have heard the stories. They could repeat them back to you. But they've never asked the question, who is this that can do these things? For if they ever answer that in the affirmative, there's something they must do.